they have a really large intern program here, but it's nice.
And what were your degrees in that attracted you to CSIS? That goes to both of you.
You're interviewing us now.
Well, I'm just asking a couple of questions before we get going.
I majored in international relations in French. I double majored.
In French?
Mm-hmm. I spent a year at Sciences Po in college. And
I'm a graduate student at Georgetown, their conflict resolution program. So I always say that my interest in nuclear weapons comes from the idea that if we could just, you know, desist from nuking each other, we could resolve a few more viruses.
Well, so far we have resisted.
For quite a while, yeah.
It's funny you say that, because when I was first offered a job at Aldermaston, I was very reluctant to go there. And then the more I thought about it, the more I decided, well, if we've got a functioning system, it's far more likely to be used. The important thing being both sides have got it, and therefore it's far less likely to be used. Now, that worked while we were facing rational opponents. It's very different now.
It's amazing how the logic seems to flow. I mean, you begin with this ideal that you don't want any nuclear weapons in the world because you don't want to see them used. But then they originated out of the fear that the Germans weren't going to get them, so then we acquired them as the only logical way that we could think to deter them. Now that we have them, if you eliminate all of them, then they give us enormous first strike capability to be the first person to break the rule and go
absolutely.
And take on a logic of their own, so now you're kind of stuck with them. And which is kind of what the Pony Initiative is about. It's not that we have them, what we do with them.
And that's why I've been so critical. We're getting off subject, but we can go back to what you want to do in a minute. That's why I've been so critical of the attempts to force Congress to support the RRW, because I maintain you first got to have a policy into which RRW fits before you try and persuade Congress to advance money. And I've had strong arguments with Murdoch and others on this very issue. It was quite funny because I'm trying to think of his name. He's in the Nuclear Regulatory Committee. Anyway, he always sends me the various things that are going through, and he sent me one which was signed off by three cabinet secretaries. So there was Energy, Defence, and what was the other one? Oh, and Energy, Defence, and it's ridiculous. But anyway, it'll come back to me. And I read this, and I went back to him, and I said, this was clearly written by officials who persuaded their cabinet secretaries to sign it off as an attempt to get Congress to finance this. But you've avoided the real issue of why do you want it? And I said, you'll get nowhere with this. This is going to bounce. And I got a letter back, an email back within about 20 minutes. So clearly he had been one of the authors objecting strongly to this insight. But of course, Congress did zero fund it. And I mean, it's not that I don't believe the RRW is a good idea. But if you want Congress to fork up large sums, you've got to put it in context.
And that speaks to your point earlier about actually thinking a little bit longer term.
That's right.
So we've got we've reconfigured our nuclear posture into this capabilities based approach. And basically then your nuclear deterrent and your forces are structured based on the animating principle is what can we do?
Absolutely.
Rather than what's happening. Let's take an analysis of what should be done and what will get us to where we need to be. The emphasis is, how can we build our strengths? What can we do? So
that's
then your capabilities are driving your policy rather than rational
absolutely.
Analysis of what's actually
well,
happening.
Well, that's where the fellow that I asked for this book is a retired U.S. Army general, and we've collaborated together for over 20 years. Both been retired now for 17 years, but we've collaborated the whole time, and we've written over 100 articles, and most of our articles are on these lines of, never mind today and tomorrow. What about next week? I pulled one out the other day where the states were first going across to Poland and Czechoslovakia to put the missile defense systems in, and I hadn't realized it was written in 2004. And we said, hold it. We can see what you want to do, but once the governments of these countries realize that by putting it there, you make them potential targets, they're going to react very differently. At the minute, they think this is great. They've just come out of the Soviet Union. They're collaborating with the US. But hang on, you haven't thought it through.
They forgot why we had an ABM in the first place. Right. It's almost as if they completely forgot why we did that.
That's right. And what I find remarkable now, of course, Poland and the government of Poland, hold it. I mean, you know, hang on. Putin said he'll target us. Now, again, this was... It wasn't brilliant foresight on our part. It was so obvious, but nobody said anything.
But we're pushing it through anyway.
They're trying to push it through.
But they're saying the justification is Iran, but they're not addressing
the other stupid thing was, when they did it, they were locating it there for North Korea. It's not well located for Iran. That's another story that people don't talk about.
I think it doesn't jive with the concern over Iran. It's basically the possible connection between an Iranian bomb and a terrorist getting their hands on it.
That's right.
At least the material.
And that doesn't jive.
And all of a sudden, now you're talking about missile defense. Well, when were we talking about missiles? Now, of course, it doesn't. Of course, Iran has some missile capability, and there's ways that they can increase them. But the justification for it all doesn't jive with our broader policy. Russia, of course, knows that anything that we field isn't necessarily, this may not be true. I don't know, it's the argument's a little bit beyond me, but I think Russia's got capabilities, as far as I know, pretty far beyond anything we're capable of shooting down with it.
Well, it's a different situation. They can overwhelm, totally. There's no question about it. And again, I've been involved in this from the very beginning. The ideas that Reagan was pushing at the beginning was to try and combat an enormous raid, basically, so literally hundreds or thousands, by using particle beams and or lasers. None of that has come to fruition. So you're still engaged on a one-by-one situation. And with that, you couldn't possibly counter a raid of hundreds or thousands. You can counter singles or tens. So you're facing a different situation. Now, let's put it in perspective. I'm greatly in favour of missile defence as what I call an interim solution against the terrorist threats, providing you locate them in the right places. that's one of the problems. In other words, they do need European soil, and the Europeans should be doing more. I was invited across in October for a week to France. I could have done with your translation, but I cope. It's funny, as a kid, I had an aunt who lived in Paris, and I used to go across and spend holidays with her. So I used to wander around Paris, and I could get by very well, but it's all gone now, my French. Totally. But anyway, they all spoke enough English. But I spent a week going through with them to try and straighten out their views on missile defence, because they'd all been very, very anti, all the Europeans. And they really got to face up to the issues that it does provide an interim solution. And to be effective, you've got to have assets there as well as here. So, yeah, but it's like we were saying, that only gets you so far. You've still got to cope with the longer term problem. But anyway, sorry, I've taken you right off subject.
Oh, okay. That's okay. All right, so we'll begin now, if that's okay. My name is Tara Callahan, and I'm with the International Security Program at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. Today is January 24th, 2008. And I'm here with Dr. Stanley Orman as part of the PONY project to evaluate U.S.-UK nuclear cooperation as we approach the 50th anniversary of the Mutual Defense Agreement. Dr. Orman, if you could begin by briefly describing your career to date.
Yes, all right. I'll try and be brief. I got a doctorate at King's London in chemistry, and did a postdoctoral fellowship at Brandeis University. We came across as newlyweds, and much to our surprise, we went back with an American son. I then joined Aldermaston, which at that time was the Atomic Weapons Research Establishment. They've now changed it to AWE, taking the research out, and it was the research that interested me. I spent several years there as a scientist, getting more and more involved in US-UK relations at that time, and serving on Joe Woggs. I then moved over into project management and started as what was called the Coordinating Research and Development Authority for Britain's then planned nuclear deterrent, specially designed to counter the Russian ABM defences which were being erected around Moscow. I worked on that programme for 7 years, ending up as the chief engineer and signing the documentation to put the missile into service. And it went into service in 1982 and stayed in through 1995. After that, I came across here as a minister in the British Embassy, responsible for all defence exchanges between the US and the UK. And if I tell you that Falklands War was on at that time, I was here from 82 to 84. So it was a very active period of US-UK collaboration. I went back as deputy director of Aldermaston, and again got very involved in Joe Woggs, but this time chairing major meetings rather than being a junior scientist. I then moved on as the founding director general of our SDI participation office, which meant I was heading the British involvement with the missile defence programme, which had been started in 1983 here. In that position, we were the first to sign a memorandum of understanding for participation in SDI, and I managed to work into the expansion of that memorandum a whole series of exchange meetings based exclusively on Joe Woggs, because I'd been so impressed with the 1958 agreement and the Joe Wogg exchanges. And again, those exchanges in missile defence continue to this day. I retired 10 years early from the Ministry of Defence and came out here because my son, who'd been born an American, decided to exercise his right as an American to stay after our embassy duties. He married. When they announced they were having a grandchild, we didn't want to be grandparents 3,500 miles away, and I've been here ever since.
To what extent do you feel like the British decision to develop an independent nuclear deterrent was based on Cold War considerations? If there wasn't a Soviet threat, would the British still have wanted to develop nuclear deterrent?
Exclusively. It was totally a Cold War situation. I mean, there was no question. It complicated the Russian or the Soviet thinking at that time, because it gave two centres that they had to be concerned, and of course the French went as well, made three centres. So there was no question about it, and the British really did develop an independent nuclear deterrent, despite the opinion which has since grown up, because a lot of British scientists were involved at Los Alamos. They went back, and that formed the nucleus of AWRE, and Bill Penny, or Dr. William Penny as he was first known, became the director of AWRE. AWRE produced a successful atomic explosion in the mid-50s, and by 57 had successfully exploded a hydrogen bomb, which proved British had made the same breakthroughs as existed in the US, and that's what led to the US-UK agreement, the 1958 agreement that we're now discussing. An interesting sideline on that is Winston Churchill was the Prime Minister when Penny went out to the Pacific to conduct that hydrogen test, and he had two telegrams prepared depending on the result of the test. The first one read, good try, William, hard luck. The second one said, congratulations, Sir William Penny. And he was literally knighted on the successful explosion of the first hydrogen bomb.
What kind of impact do you think the MDA had on the special relationship, in your opinion? You said you worked for the AWRE in 1961, so did you see the effects of it immediately?
Yes, very, very significantly. The American involvement or investment in nuclear warhead work was at least 10 times that of the British. So it meant that we had a big advantage initially on getting far broader experience than we could have gained with our limited program. But what I saw was that the Americans gained too, because when we had a problem, we had, with our limited resources, we had to really put in an enormous amount of what I call brain power to solve the problem we had, whereas the American approach was to use your much greater resources to place multiple contracts on independent groups and have a horse race. Who could solve the problem? We used brain power. We would sit around and brainstorm for ages until we came to a potential solution, just one, which we would then work on, mainly in-house, and do the necessary development work. So as a result, we brought much greater depth in areas than the American teams brought. The American teams brought much greater breadth. So over a period of years, it became a very beneficial, mutually beneficial exchange program because of the depth that we brought to issues as composed to the breadth which the Americans brought.
What was the belief system like in 1961 regarding nuclear weapons work in Great Britain? Did a lot of people feel like it was, you know, really important, like really crucial to the future of the nation, or what? And as a scientist, among other scientists in that time frame,
it was never a popular program in the UK. The Labour government, which had succeeded after the war, was very anti-nuclear, although they had agreed to start the program. Many of the Labour leadership used to march every year in what was called the Aldermaston March to literally close Aldermaston and stop nuclear weapon development. Now, what was quite fascinating was in the mid-60s, and I don't remember the exact date, Labour came back into power under Harold Wilson, and at least half the cabinet had been leading these Aldermaston marches, including Wedgie Benn, who became the Minister of Technology, and our Atomic Energy Authority was in the Ministry of Technology. So formally, Wedgie Benn was the minister responsible for Aldermaston. Now, an interesting statement, and I was quite junior at the time, so I don't know the full details, but I know people at the top were saying, he will never step into Aldermaston. We won't give him a clearance. And so you had this fascinating situation that the cabinet minister in charge literally didn't step in. Now, what Labour did at that time, they didn't want to stop the programme dead, but they never put any new work in at that time. No decisions were taken, and Aldermaston were told to diversify and use their capabilities to help industry on a broader scale. And, of course, we developed a lot of capabilities. And in fact, at that time, I'd been studying the corrosion of uranium and uranium alloys and plutonium components, which were essential to the nuclear program. And I put in a suggestion to undertake a survey of the cost of corrosion to the country on a much broader scale. Of course, not nuclear materials. This was on this diversification concept, which was taken up by the Ministry of Technology. And I was given 18 months leave of absence from Alder Marsden to head the secretariat of this committee. And we did a total survey on the cost of corrosion to the country and ways of avoiding this or alleviating the cost. Now, during that period, or prior to that period, I said I'd been working on the corrosion of uranium and its components. And what I discovered quite quickly was that although I was asked to look at the effect of plastics and coatings and rubbers, which were all integral in the design, and whether these were causing the corrosion of the uranium, I recognised that all these plastics and materials contain water, and water can diffuse out in a closed environment. So the important thing was to understand the uranium water reaction. And what I found in the literature and then talking to people on both sides of the Atlantic was nobody had ever managed to get uniform data on the uranium water reaction. Every time somebody studied it, they got totally different rates. It was some people actually said to me, it depends on the phase of the moon. So cut a long story short, I used my chemistry background and did it in very carefully controlled environments where I excluded all air and just did a uranium water reaction and then put back small quantities of nitrogen and oxygen and carbon dioxide and so on. And what I found was that minute traces of oxygen, and I'm talking about parts per thousand, inhibited the uranium water reaction and slowed it by a factor of 50-fold, which was why nobody ever managed to get, because depending on the size vessel that you do it on, there might be more oxygen or less oxygen. And once the oxygen is consumed, you get a different reaction. Hydrogen is produced from the uranium water reaction, and the actual rate goes up about 50-fold. Now, the importance of this was that if you filled your warhead with nitrogen gas, you got a much faster uranium water reaction than if you filled it with oxygen or air. It sounds silly, but these are important factors, and this is where I come back to the UK doing things in much more detail. Now, if you've got no oxygen present, I said you get hydrogen produced. That hydrogen could go into other components, and in some cases it could actually diffuse in and stop them functioning in the way they were designed to function. Now, since these components were absolutely essential for the nuclear weapon to behave as a true nuclear weapon, it meant there were devices there which could actually stop them functioning. And it was this research that I did that so interested the US. And we found that had we filled ours with nitrogen, as the American design did, within a few weeks, the weapon would have ceased to function as a nuclear warhead. And this caused the Americans to change their design. Now, the interesting thing is, at the time I discovered this, Labour had just come back into power. And I was being sucked dry on JOWOG meetings, literally sucked dry. I mean, you had people from all your establishments there. And I was just exhausted with the questions that were coming in, but nothing was coming back. And eventually I really worked on someone and said, what's happening? And they said, well, we're not sure whether we can tell you this because you've got a Labour government and we're not sure how Labour's going to behave in the future. But they then admitted that they'd done the tests and confirmed that I was right, and some of their stockpile would not have functioned as a stockpile. But anyway, it all went right afterwards. We got it right. And labor never actually stopped the work.
You keep mentioning your work on the joint working groups or JOWGs. Can you explain to the average layperson what these meetings were initially and how they developed over time?
Sure. Well, the whole concept was, if you say you're going to exchange information, how do you exchange it? So they set up a series of joint working groups, hence JOWGs. The joint working groups initially were on specifically warhead information. So you'd have hydrodynamics, which is the way you implode a warhead to make it work. Material science, which was very important, and it was the material science ones that I was heavily involved with. And other design features. So it started out with a small series of specific meetings where experts from both sides could sit down and describe difficulties which they had encountered in their own designs and how they resolved these, and exchanges occurred. Now, a very interesting side effect that happened at that time, but I think has been changed over the years, was that because Los Alamos and Livermore were separate entities, and the Americans believe very much in always having duplicate, at least, groups, whereas Britain was quite content to have one, the scientists of Livermore and Los Alamos really didn't meet and discuss their problems. They were almost discouraged from doing so at that time to keep this independence. And Sandia had two groups, which one which supported Los Alamos and one which supported Sandia, Livermore. So the American groups didn't meet except when they came to these US-UK meetings. And what we found very often was when we were discussing something, an American from Los Alamos would say, "Hey, we've had that problem." And some from Livermore would say, "We too. Now, how did you tackle it?" So a lot of benefit, indirectly, came from the American teams meeting at that time. Now, I'm assured that this has, 30 years on, has changed. But at that time, there was far more collaboration established between the American groups than existed outside of the US-UK meetings.
I was interviewing Dr. Pete Nanos, and he was mentioning that the UK functioned almost as a third laboratory for Lawrence Livermore and Los Alamos. How true has this been in your experience as a scientist?
This was very true, as I said, because we did so much in depth. And the other thing is we brought different problems to the table because the design was always, in words, simple terminology, anglicized. It was never a direct copy. So there was an anglicization, and you learnt something from that. Also, when we started doing the underground nuclear tests, which was much later when all the atmospheric testing stopped, we were dependent on using the Nevada facility. And we did our own design, but this always had to be disclosed to the US side in full detail, because after all, we were bringing a device over and sinking it in the ground here. What we found was there was enormous competition to be the laboratory which liaised with us on those tests. And to avoid too much argument, the US authorities said, right, we're going to do it on a one-by-one basis. So it's Los Alamos first time, Livermore next time, Los Alamos, because there was such competition to be involved in this, because we brought new problems, new concepts, new ideas, and both teams wanted to get in on those.
I think there's been traditional arguments that the relationship's been one-sided. Can you tell us about the benefits that both sides have received from the special partnership?
I explained in the first case, we brought much greater depth in certain areas. We also brought capabilities which we had devised, which the Americans didn't have. Again, you had far more than we did, but in some cases we had a unique niche capability. Now, we happened to have someone over in the UK called Charlie Martin, who was a unique individual in terms of high energy physics. And he had devised some X-ray capabilities which could measure the in extremely small time frame, the implosion characteristics. These were totally unique because he found ways of X-raying through a steel containment bomb, which is very, very difficult to X-ray through. But he found ways of doing this, and this was a unique capability which existed only with us and not with the US. Later, we also devised a technique, again through the Charlie Martin, of imploding a non-fissile plutonium isotope. Now, because it was plutonium, the laws in the States would not allow you to implode this, even though it was non-fissile, because it was plutonium. So again, this was another capability which the American scientists would come across and use in our laboratories because they couldn't use there. That's just two examples of niche capabilities which were developed over in the UK. So it always was a two-way process.
So before the Mutual Defense Agreement was instituted, there was the McMahon Act, which severely restricted U.S. cooperation with other countries. Do you think that the McMahon Act was merited at the time? Can you tell us about it from the British perspective?
You're going here well before I got involved. So I was fortunate enough to get to join Alder Marston when the JOWOGs had started, and I was in. I could understand why people brought a McMahon Act, and that was, let's ensure that nuclear weapons secrets don't spread. I mean, if you like, it was a start of non-proliferation. but the UK had their own way of breaking through that, as I explained, that so we were in.
Okay, you were personally involved on the UK side of the SDI, the Strategic Defense Initiative. How much did the UK play a role in SDI policy planning as opposed to the US? And were there ever tensions, and how were these worked out?
I like to say that I was involved in SDI for about 7 years before the great communicator came along and told us what we were working on. And that was because when the Russians, or the Soviets, I keep saying the Russians, but it's the Soviets, when the Soviets decided to, after the 1972, what was the? I'm trying to think of the. It wasn't the ABM treaty. Yes, the 1972, the ABM treaty was signed. That limited the number of defensive missiles which could be deployed. The Soviets and the Americans both deployed a system at that time. You decided, I say you, even though I'm now an American, the Americans decided to protect their second strike missiles. The Soviets decided to protect their seat of government around Moscow. Within a short time, the Americans dismantled their safeguard facility. The Soviets kept improving their facility. And it was recognized by the British, who just deployed Polaris, that a Polaris boat, or the missiles on a Polaris boat, would not be able to penetrate the Soviet avian defenses. So we no longer had a deterrent, or would no longer have a deterrent. The Americans turned to MIRV systems. The British had only just deployed Polaris and didn't want to invest in new boats for Poseidon. The other factor was the Americans had far more systems than we did. We relied on just four boats, and we could only guarantee to have one boat at sea at that time. So the question was, could we modify the Polaris to contain a lot of penetration aids, which would be so effective that the Soviets would have to fire far more missiles to neutralize each warhead, or each missile, each payload. That was the start of the Chevalier program. The Americans had been looking at a decoy program before they went to the Poseidon, and they called that Antelope and then Super Antelope. We took the concepts of the Super Antelope and modified that to produce our Chevalier program. And that was the program where I moved in as the CRDA and ended up as the chief engineer. Basically, we took one warhead off of the three warheads that were there, replaced it with a penetration aid carrier. This penetration aid carrier could motor around in the sky deploying, pardon me, another one of the two warheads and a series of penetration aids, such that you got a very large, widely spread payload which would face the Soviet ABM defenses. It was so effective at the end that we later tried, when it came out of service, we later utilized some of our payloads in tests under the SDI banner, and I was able to arrange that, even though I'd come out, and in fact I was over here retired, but I was still helping, as it were, from both sides. And they were still highly effective, even against your more modern capabilities. So we had produced a very effective system. And what was interesting was, after the Cold War started to collapse, Gorbachev came over and had a meeting with Margaret Thatcher, who was Prime Minister, and asked her how we had managed to replace the three warheads on Chevalier with six. They thought we had six genuine warheads. In effect, we only had two, and we had a lot of penetration aids. So that was quite interesting. But when, to really answer your question about how much influence we had on the American program, when President Reagan made his speech announcing the introduction of SDI, it was heavily decried throughout the rest of the world and even in the States, because there'd been no prior preparation for this sudden dramatic change. Europe became very concerned because they had the impression that much of the work that yet had to be done had been done, and America were now going to be impregnable and could shelter behind their defence, and the whole concept of extended deterrence had gone. So I, if you like, when we signed the MOU, I became almost the, I called myself the tame European. I was explaining that this was a total misunderstanding and could never be so. And it had more effect because, as a European, I, if you like, carried more weight than an American coming over and saying it wasn't going to happen. The other thing was that because we'd done so much work on penetrating an existing defence, the Soviet ABM defences, I was then Deputy Director of Aldermaston, to bring together all the British establishments. That was Farnborough, our Royal Aircraft Establishment, the Royal Signals and Radar Establishment, RSRE, and other establishments, to get an assessment of how effective could a missile defence really be, and what did we have to offer the Americans if we signed an MOU. And I produced a report that went directly to the Prime Minister. And on the strength of that, the Prime Minister did sign the, or instruct the Secretary of Defence, and I say instruct because the Secretary of Defence at the time did not want to sign it, signed an MOU for our participation. And my argument was twofold. Memorandum of Understanding. Sorry, MOU, Memorandum of Understanding. And my argument was twofold at the time. One, because we'd worked so heavily on countering a missile defence, we had a lot to offer the states who were now trying to erect a missile defence, in the same way that a poacher has much to offer a gamekeeper, because he says, I know the ways that I can get in. The second one was that the Cold War was still in existence. We had our own independent deterrent, which we assumed was still effective against the existing Soviet defences. It was important that we understood what advances would be made in defence capabilities, so that if the Soviets were to make advances and improvements in theirs, we would be pre-prepared and could make similar improvements in ours to counter them. So it was a twofold one, that we felt we had a lot to offer the US, and we felt it was important that we got very involved in the US program to understand where the potential for improvements lay, so that we could counter anything the Soviets might pick up.
In your experience throughout your career, how much do you feel like the special partnership is driven by diplomatic considerations, and how much by personal relationships?
Well, first of all, it is driven by diplomatic. And I think it's driven more by defence than anything else. When I was in the embassy, I used to have several long discussions with our then ambassador, who was not a scientist, and had been very experienced in the diplomatic side his whole career. And he too was convinced that the special relationship was built on defence issues, defence of the realm. Now, most times, the special relationship is not built on personal relationships, with one major exception, and in fact I'll now make it two major exceptions, and that was the missile defence side, and even more so the nuclear warhead side. Because the nuclear warhead programmes tended to be closed, people who went in as junior scientists stayed in that programme and worked their way through and eventually became senior members. It meant that when you started exchanging as a junior member of a JOWOG, 20 years later, you might be running major programs, and someone that you had formed a relationship with 20 years earlier was running that program from the other side. So there really was a relationship, personal relationships built up. There was trust. You knew what you could say. You knew that if the other fellow shook your hand, it would happen. That was unique at that time in US-UK exchanges. The same thing started to develop while I was there under the missile defence side, because again we had these exchanges going on. But generally speaking, in the broader area of exchanges, people move about so much and so frequently that you don't get these relationships built up. exactly the same, incidentally, built up under the submarine missile programs, because there was a Polaris sales agreement. Again, same sort of thing. People in the SSPO this side, that was the Strategic Systems Project Office, that's right, they tended to come in and stay in. And many of our naval people on our strategic side came in and stayed in. So you had, again, that build-up. But it was these closed, special relationships that built up individual bonding, which helped enormously to get things done. Normally, when you try and get a new form of exchange, transatlantic, it is so complex because of the various rules and regulations that exist, particularly on the US side, which, believe it or not, is far more bureaucratic than the US side, than the UK side, that often, before you can get the necessary exchange established, the ones who started to try and establish it have moved on to other jobs and it peters out. So it was these particular exchanges, the Polaris Sales Agreement, the MDA, as you called it, the Mutual Defence Agreement, and the SDI ones, where there were closed shops, that you really did get these relationships established.
Were there any stereotypes on the British side towards the Americans and vice versa that you had of each other?
I don't think so. I don't recall anything. When you say stereotypes, it's almost as though it has a negative connotation. Did you mean it negatively?
I mean, expectations of the other side that when you went into the joint working groups, you overcame, like, a perception of, for example, the U.S. being overly bureaucratic and then making progress eventually.
Well, let's face it, the scientists were never bureaucratic. The administrators are bureaucratic. Let me give you one example of that, which is not directly on this, but it explains what I mean. When I was here in the embassy, I used to work very closely with senior government officials in DOD, because I was then right across the board. And I became very friendly, and I won't mention his name, with the then Deputy Secretary of Defense in the US side. And I was intrigued because he became Deputy Secretary of Defense while I was in post. And it was reported that he'd had a salary well in excess of $1 million a year at that time, which was 1982-83. And he'd been a captain of industry. And he'd come in, and at that time, I suppose, Deputy Secretary of Defense earned something like $150,000 a year. So me being me, I got to know him quite well, and we were at a social gathering, drinking each other's health. And I said, tell me, what... what drives someone to give up a salary in excess of $1 million a year to join the government at a salary far less? And he explained to me that when the president calls you up and calls you by first name and says, I especially want you to join it, it's very hard to say no. So, all right, I understood that. And I said, well, now you're in, and he'd been in then about 9 months. I said, you know, how are you enjoying it? And he said, I have never been so frustrated in my life. And I said, you know, why? And he said, when I was in industry, I had perhaps 50,000 staff. And he said, I would make a decision, and 50,000 staff marched in the right direction to implement my decision. He said, I have never got one thing yet to work in DOD. He said, every time I say something's going to be done, people pop up at very junior level and say, well, there's a regulation, so-and-so-and-so-and-so, that says you can't do this. And there's a regulation, so-and-so-and-so, that you can't do that. And he said, I don't think I've achieved anything yet in 9 months. That's what I call bureaucracy.
Are there any counterparts you particularly recall working well with? Can you tell me...
Sorry?
Like, counterparts that you recall working particularly well with. And can you tell me what that was like on a personal level for you?
Yeah. the first one I remember was Don Adolfson from Sandia. His initials were D.R. Adolfson, so he always said he didn't have to get a doctorate. He was born with one. But he and I became very, very friendly. Now, he was the gentleman that invited me across to first talk about the corrosion of uranium side, because he had placed contracts, and again, here we come back to this contractual. They had the problem, they knew there was a problem, and they placed contracts with various universities. And he wanted me to go with him to a university in Ohio, where they had just completed some work which conflicted totally with my results. They said oxygen had no effect on the uranium water reaction, whereas I said it had this enormous effect. And I went with him for a discussion with the two professors, and it quickly turned out that the two professors that had the contract, they were full established professors, the work was being done by postgrad students, neither of whom spoke very good English. They were limited. And they described their work, and I was quickly able to establish that what they said was the uranium water reaction was my rate for uranium water oxygen reaction, the inhibited, in other words. And I went through in detail how they'd done their work. And they'd done it by flowing gas over water vapor to get the water vapor, and then over the uranium, and they'd measured the rate of reaction. And I said, well, they flowed nitrogen gas or oxygen gas, and they got the same results in both. And I said, well, but did you use what is called white spot nitrogen? And they said, no, we just used ordinary bottled nitrogen. And I said, well, then did you analyze that nitrogen for oxygen content? And there were mutters, and then they said, well, yes, but it was only parts per thousand. And I said, but we've just shown that parts per thousand actually inhibits it. And what you've said is the uranium water reaction, uranium water oxygen reaction. And I always remember Don prodding me as we were then taken into lunch by the two professors that were visiting, and he said to me, whatever you do, don't take the first piece you cut off. And I said, what do you mean? He said, they want you to choke on it. But just a little aside there. But Don and I stayed, and when he moved on to other jobs, he was replaced by Nick Magnani, and we too had a very good relationship. So those relationships went right the way through. And I remember when Don and then Nick later were chairing major meetings from the US side, and I was chairing them from the UK side. And I first met Don in 1963, and we still email each other regularly. He now lives in California. So, yes, those are the sort of relationships that built up.
Were there ever any tensions that you recall?
I can't recall any severe ones, no. I mean, there undoubtedly must have been at times. Mainly, again, because as scientists, both sides tended to want to find a solution. So if someone had a better idea than your side had, you were most interested in exploring it. It wasn't a case of, oh, you know, they're saying I'm wrong. In fact, I'll tell you something very interesting there. It's amazing what comes back as you think about these things. At another time, I was working with other British scientists on problems with plutonium. Now, I don't want to get into something which is too classified, but at one point, plutonium gets exposed to an isomer of hydrogen, tritium, actually. And you don't want the plutonium to be degraded too quickly. But it's essential to have that tritium in there as part of the functioning. Both sides were very concerned about this. One of my British colleagues discovered an inhibitor that could stop the, or sufficiently slow the plutonium hydrogen reaction to allow everything to function as it should. But it really was a major change in design to add this. And the British, because they did far fewer underground tests, had far fewer capabilities, were very reluctant to make this design change. So we exposed this through the JOWOGs. The Americans cottoned onto this very quickly and did the necessary underground tests and confirmed that everything was all right. And then the British designers were willing to take on something which we had discovered, but they were very reluctant to do. Now that's, if you like, that's a form of tension. But again, the scientists found a way of working this round.
Did you evolve, or did you witness the relationship evolve over time, and in what way?
Well, it evolved because, as I explained, as people worked their way up, the trust grew, the understanding grew. So yes, it became a meeting of comrades and friends, and the exchanges became much easier. And I think that happens whenever you've got what I'd call a closed environment, because they were groups and they were working their way up. So it's all the same sort of story that I've told you before, that it really did cooperate. New people came in as lasers became more important. That brought in a whole new group of individuals, but then they established their relationships and so on.
But how is that affected by diplomacy? I mean, yesterday Gordon Brown gave a speech saying that when the NPT comes up for ratification in 2010, Great Britain will be advocating a world free of nuclear weapons, total disarmament, and these type of things. So as those political statements start to change, how does the relationship change?
I might point out to you that the pressure at the minute for a world free of nuclear weapons is coming from such established figures as Kissinger. And there were four of them wrote that article. That's right. Cohen and Nunn. That's right. So it's not just coming from the British side. Personally, I understand what's motivating them. But I think at this stage, it's pie in the sky to talk about a world free of nuclear weapons. It's something that we were discussing before we started recording these things. The concept is fine. It's how you can ensure that some of the nasties aren't going to break their word. I liken it to the time when there was a lot of pressure on governments to say, will you sign a no first use policy? Well, all right, you can sign a no first use policy. What happens when the other side, having signed it, say, well, we're really up against it, we're going to use it? Agreements can only take you so far. So, yes, I understand that people would love a nuclear-free world. The problem is, as people say, how do you put a cork back in the bottle? You might get a cork back, but the genie's out. So Yes, there's a lot of pressure on British administrations, particularly Labour. Labour have never liked it. And the other thing is, don't forget, those who are leading the party today were brought up on the abhorrence of nuclear weapons. So it's very difficult to change something that you basically, you know, you took in with your mother's milk. And it was the same way why people were so against missile defence, because they saw it as a means of prolonging the existence of nuclear weapons. I've never saw it in that way, but you understand how if people have grown up thinking in a particular way, it's very difficult to change your whole thinking structure. And, you know, and to use an expression people use, most people don't think outside the box.
Some people argue that the British nuclear deterrent is affected negatively by its technical reliance on the United States. What effect do you think the question of independence has had during your career on both perception and practical decision-making for both countries?
It's definitely affected by it. I mean, there's no question. The British have gained considerably from the exposure to the much broader US program. So in that sense, no question that that they are affected. But many of the advances which the Americans have made over these years have also been affected by the British thinking. Because I described to you earlier how there was a competition between the US laboratories to be the US laboratory liaising with each British underground test. And we did far fewer, but nonetheless, we always brought something new and novel to the table. And that was then absorbed by the American side and taken in to theirs. So that's why I've always said it's been a mutually beneficial, and it's certainly affected both sides in terms of their design and conceptual thinking. What I disagree with is that the British couldn't have had nuclear weapons and maintained nuclear weapons without the US collaboration. And that is what often comes up on the political side, not on the scientific and engineering side. That in fact, some go much further and claim that all our foreign policy is controlled by US thinking and almost dictatorship because we have the mutual defense agreement. And I really don't believe that, but some believe it firmly.
What do you think is the strategic importance of the renewal of the Trident system on both sides of the Atlantic?
Well, because both sides were trying to think ahead of what's going to happen. The Americans have been going down a very difficult path at the minute, trying to say, can we put conventionally armed missiles into Trident boats, so we've got a very rapid but non-nuclear response if we need it. I understand again why they're doing it. Very, very difficult, because when anyone sees something coming out of a Trident boat, I don't need to finish the sentence. So that is being actively investigated in the US. Can you do anything? Now, the UK have a different approach to long-term planning. They write what is called white papers. The British wrote a white paper which said Trident boats are coming to the end of their life. We, at this stage, don't see an end to the potential use of these Trident boats. So we're going to renew the Trident boats. They didn't say anything at that stage about the war. So to use another expression, they kicked it downstream. Kick the can along. Wait for the next government to face that problem. So both sides, by acknowledging that they don't know what else to do at this stage, say, well, we'll have to continue with some form of, and I use inverted commas, deterrence, because I'm not sure what we're deterring or how we're deterring it. But because the Cold War thinking hasn't gone away, there is still this belief that you can deter by having nuclear weapons. Now, with some of the, I won't say forces, but some of the issues that we now face and some of the non-state actors that we now face, it's very difficult to understand what deterrence means in that context. And these are some of the issues that I and colleagues are trying to wrap our minds around, on the grounds that we've been involved in it for so long. Can we bring something new to the table? And we're not the only ones thinking about this. A lot of people are. But I believe that technology at the minute is well ahead of policy thinking. And we haven't developed a new policy to replace the old Cold War thinking on nuclear deterrence.
Do you think the US would benefit from its own version of a white paper, for example?
They'd obviously benefit in the sense it would make people at senior levels think through the long-term implications. You see, a problem that I see, particularly on the US side, more than the UK even, is the House of Representatives, people come in for a 2-year stay. Their main object when they get elected is to get re-elected. I don't believe they have the opportunity of really thinking through long-term implications which affect the country and even the alliance as a whole, rather than what do they have to do to satisfy their own constituents so they can be re-elected. So in that sense, nearly all the House of Representatives, local issues totally dominate. Senate has 6 years, so there should be some more forward thinking. But again, it's become so partisan, unfortunately, that I see very few senators who take what I call a US view, or even worse, even more importantly, a Western alliance view of issues, rather than, again, you know, what do I have to do to please my contributors and my supporters? The UK side is somewhat different because so many of these papers come from the established civil service, which is a permanent situation, which runs right through from the most junior levels where I entered to the permanent undersecretary who sits alongside the cabinet minister. And dare I say it probably has as much say as the cabinet minister in terms of the policy. So these papers are written by, if you like, a professional establishment. Now on the US side, you bring in far more political appointees into the various arms of government. And although you have made a big step forward with the SES, Senior Executive Service, still the ones who really govern the policy in your various government establishments are the political appointees rather than an established civil service which is apolitical. So I think it's much harder for you to produce these far-sighted white papers than it is because of the very procedures which we use to produce them.
How do you think that the US and UK differ in their diplomatic approaches to non-proliferation?
You're getting beyond my field, honestly. I haven't really looked at what's really happening in terms of non-proliferation, mainly because I believe a lot of it is pie in the sky. It's so, put it this way, it's so hard to convince other countries that they shouldn't have what you've got. Particularly because of what has happened in Iraq at this time. And by way of explanation there, I'll say that before we invaded Iraq, a colleague and myself wrote an article saying we should not say we're going into Iraq because they've got weapons of mass destruction. We're going into Iraq because we know they're working on, and at that time we thought very strongly they were working on. Now, we knew they possessed chemical and possibly some biological. We were pretty confident that they didn't actually possess a nuclear warhead. Our troops were all equipped with chemical and biological protection, but we never took the sort of precautions by not gathering our troops together for a movement, etc., that they were going to lob a nuclear warhead at us. Now, at the time, we'd identified the axis of evil, Iraq, North Korea, and Iran. We believed that North Korea and Iran were much closer to a nuclear situation than Iraq. So, our thinking in the article we wrote was that we were going into Iraq to get them before they got a nuclear weapon, not when they got it. And we said the lesson that would be learnt by everyone else would be, get a nuclear weapon and you won't be invaded. Now, we seem to have made some progress with North Korea because we got Russia and China involved. We're certainly not making much impression on Iran at the minute. But the lesson I feel that others will learn from what happened there is that if you've got a nuclear warhead, you're far less likely to be pressurized by the US, in real pressurized, in terms of an invasion, than if you haven't got one.
How important do you think the RRW is to U.S. modernization? And does the U.K. scientific community have a stake in the status of modernization programs like this?
Well, the RRW, I believe if you can make a justification for the continued possession and potential use of a nuclear weapon, then RRW is very important. Because, yes, the others are aging. And incidentally, it's important to note the aging really doesn't count nearly as much on the nuclear materials. I mean, people think it's mainly the uranium and the plute and the tritium. The tritium has to be replaced, but that's easily replaceable. It's all the plastics and rubbers that are an integral part of any design that definitely degrade and have to be replaced. And sometimes when you go to replace these have been manufactured by other companies not in the nuclear field. I mean, there may be some rubber company, might have been quite a small company. And you go back and they say, well, yeah, but we don't have the tools that could make that anymore. We never make anything in that form. So it's very, very hard to reproduce precisely something you made 25 years ago. Very hard indeed. And when you make changes, the problem is, will it behave in the same manner? So, yes, there is a need to get a reliable replacement warhead that is less likely to degrade, and they may have, I know they've all been trying to work on it, where you would have less degradation in the other materials that go on there. So if you're going to continue with nuclear warheads, yes, you've got to have a replacement eventually. And it goes on both sides of the Atlantic. So what I say on one goes on the other. But you asked me another question, and I've forgotten that bit. That's part of it.
What stake does the UK have in the RRW program?
Oh, well, it's exactly the same state that they would have in having a replacement warhead, because their warheads too are degrading. Now, we have a lifetime program. It was a regular thing that you would pull some out, you would test the rubbers and the plastics to see whether they were still in spec, and if they weren't, you often had, with ones you knew would degrade, you may have had a lot of spares in stockpile and so on under carefully controlled conditions, so they weren't being pressurized to degrade and so on and so forth. But there comes a point where you run out of spares and you can't, as I said, remanufacture them. So there are problems, and it occurs on both sides. Both sides are working with the same thing.
One of the justifications for the RRW program was also to maintain our scientific expertise here in the U.S. Does Great Britain face a similar challenge in keeping up its human capital as far as trained scientists who are able to deal with these nuclear issues?
Yeah, I mean, obviously, again, it applies both sides. When I was in the nuclear warhead game, we had an ideal situation in terms of training and maintaining your human capital. Because what happened was, you had designs being worked on for a next generation, in which you brought in young scientists, keen and energetic, and young engineers, and they were working on the concepts and the designs for a future warhead. They then, a few of those, would move on to the detailed design and the development of that warhead, while others stayed on the R&D. When that warhead went into production, some of those would move on to qualify that production and make sure all was right. And then a few of those moved on to the maintenance of the stockpile, because they knew the whole design. They were watching it. And so you were bringing scientists in as you were retiring others at the other end. It was a natural sequence of events. The minute you stop making new warheads, you no longer draw in this pool of young scientists. You've got nothing new for them to work on. Both sides have suffered from that loss. Now, there are new things coming into the Lawrence Laboratories, Lawrence Livermore and Los Alamos. This is why RRW was conceived. But if there isn't some progress on it, you start to lose that pool. And what is more dangerous is the existing pool are getting older and slipping off the other end. So the real danger is a total loss of that human capital, which really understands it all.
Are there any other anecdotal experiences that personally embody the personal relationship for you?
No, I think they've all popped out during.
Okay. What do you predict will be the future role of nuclear weapons in NATO, and how do you think this will affect the special partnership?
I really don't know where it's headed until we evolve a new security policy. I mean, I believe there probably will be a role, but I can't see it yet. Mainly because I can't see how we would use it. If, you see, let me follow a different line through. The present administration has reintroduced preemption as part of a policy. But they've never said how they would preempt. Now, one way of saying to a really hostile power is stop your warhead development or we will use a nuke to take out your facilities. No one's gone that far yet. And the main reason I think they haven't is, one is world opinion, which is changed enormously on collateral damage. If you think about it, the media reaction on the deaths, and every death is terrible, and I'm not saying otherwise, the media reaction to the number of US soldiers that have been lost in the Iraq war. The numbers are tiny compared to the number of road deaths which occur here annually. But it is played up. It's a very big issue. And others, of course, have played up and greatly exaggerated the numbers of Iraqis who have been killed in these events. You see it regularly now in the Israel-Palestine situation, that one side is lobbing short-range missiles constantly at Israel, and Israel are trying to go in and pick out those who are doing it. In both cases, innocent civilians are dying, and it's played up by the media out of all proportion. So when you've got that sort of attitude, the use of a nuclear weapon really becomes an incredibly difficult decision to take. And that's why I believe that the policy issues haven't been thought through adequately at this stage. And we're still saying, well, you know, if we're really pushed, we'll use it. Will we?
So if you were in charge of directing policy, where would you say that we should go? I mean, in the hypothetical, what would be your advice for policymakers in the future?
We've got to have... All right. I'll tell you. A very interesting book that I picked up, and it was handed out here, Towards a Grand Strategy for an Uncertain World. It was written by 5 retired chairmen or the equivalent of the Joint Chiefs. American, British, German, French, and the Netherlands. They'd all been, so they were retired generals, admirals. They're saying you need a total rethink which incorporates both military and political and other agencies, particularly on the lines of, before you take action, where's it going to lead? Can you think it through much further than we'll invade them or we'll drop a bomb? Now, for some reason, that sort of thinking hasn't been done. It hasn't been, it's not part of our culture at the minute. Particularly, if I may be critical, on the American side. This administration and the previous administration, it was all, we'll do this. And then, oh by God, we never thought of that, we'll do this. There isn't that thinking through, which to my mind is so important, and at one time was part of government thinking. I don't think it is now, and it's got to be reintroduced. And what we need are more younger people coming in with the ability, again, to think outside the box. It's not this, you know, if they do this, we'll do this, if we'll do... Think on a much broader scale. I mean, what they're saying there is, stop the whole concept that you can do this alone. It's got to be alliance. And what they make the point there, very clearly in that book, and I agree totally, is that the United Nations, that NATO, the EU, none of these groups are equipped in any way to do this broad thinking at the minute. So I'm not giving you a solution, but I'm giving you a route to get to a solution. That there's got to be a totally new approach to this by bringing in all the forces. It's no use having a military that go and do something and then turn around to the administration and say, all right, now it's over to you policy boys. It's too late. You may have broken something that you didn't want to break.
Can you comment on the trilateral French, Great Britain, U.S. relationship and how that's played itself out through the special relationship? And what role does France have as the third nuclear power in the transatlantic?
Well, for a long time, there was virtually no interaction. All the time I was there, there was virtually no interaction between the U.S. and France on the nuclear side. It was U.S., UK, and to a lesser extent, US, France. And the US got very involved with France, particularly introducing some of the US concepts on safety measures. I mean, we didn't talk about it earlier, but safety of nuclear weapons, and I don't just mean securing it from somebody else getting it, but to ensure that there is no inadvertent nuclear explosion, is an incredibly important part of nuclear design in terms of Britain and America. America at one time were concerned that the French may not have had the same degree of concern. And let me explain to you, when I was designing Chevalier, we designed a new warhead for Chevalier. And the British, which follows the American side, I mean, you can take it as either side, have very stringent design requirements to ensure that there cannot be an inadvertent nuclear explosion. And the way we take it, the way we interpret that in engineering terms is that you've got to have three totally independent safety breaks to ensure that it couldn't explode as a nuclear weapon before you want it to explode. Now that means that you have three independent breaks so that it can't function until it's actually launched. And in fact, well after launch, as it turns out. Now, when we were designing the one for Chevalier, we were fairly well advanced with the design, and we said, oh, they closed something on the submarine 1 second prior to launch that we thought was closed at launch. So we went back to the safety panels and we said, look, we found that something happens on the submarine 1 second prior to launch. And we now only have two independent safety frames. And they said, unsatisfactory. You have to introduce another safety break. Now, you just think of the attempt to stop something launching 1 second prior to submarines, by their very nature, are not in easy contact with anyone. And when you get... if you'd got permission to launch, no one's going to be able to do anything 1 second prior to launch. But the safety panel said, no, you're not meeting our criteria. And it cost us a hell of a lot of money and a hell of a lot of time. We had to introduce another safety brain. So this is an indication of the amount of effort that goes into safety to avoid any risk of a nuclear explosion when it shouldn't happen. Now, for a long time, the Americans were concerned that were the French taking the same approach? And that, I think that's what started the US-French. I may be wrong, but that was my impression. Now, there is much more US-French, US-UK and French-UK collaboration on concepts and things. I still don't believe there's much warhead exchange between the UK and the French. And I don't think there's a lot of warhead exchange in the same way as there is between the US and the UK, between the French and the US. But there's much more collaboration on the conceptual potential use, how it would be integrated into NATO and so on and so forth. So that has improved over the years.
So what you're saying, that there is an actual exchange between the US and UK on warheads, like warhead technology?
The US and the UK?
Isn't that something that's kind of...
No, I mean the whole MDA is that you exchange detailed meetings.
The actual warhead technology was precluded.
No. What is it precluded is warhead exchange.
Uh-huh.
Warhead technology is integral. It's an integral part of it. And we are even permitted to exchange highly enriched uranium, plutonium.
Which we've done.
Tritium. At one time, you ran out of tritium, and we were providing you with the trit. So that is all. It's integral. The warhead technology is integral to the exchange. Warheads themselves excluded.